With one eye on the president's Twitter feed and the other on the latest inflation readings, we will make this make sense, I promise. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the 12th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There is talk, and I know you've heard this before, but there is talk of a China trade deal this afternoon. So we will keep an eye out if it happens. But we begin today for reals with a topic never far from top of mind for economic journalists. Inflation. Or rather, as we have said, I honestly don't know how many times on this program, the lack of inflation in an economy that really should be seeing prices go up. And they're just not at a macro level. So what gives? Well, one insight came from Fed Chair Jay Powell in his press conference yesterday in response to a question, by the way, from our very own Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Chair Powell, why aren't we seeing stronger wage gains? Wages are growing more slowly now than they were toward the beginning of the year. Why is that?
Powell did that thing that Fed chairs do, talk for a while, and then he said this.
The idea that you can make, manufacture, or even provide services anywhere in the world to anywhere in the world, I think that hangs over the wage-setting process and everywhere, pretty much. You don't see, there isn't the kind of traction in the wage market that even in a tight labor market.
In other words, American workers are competing increasingly with workers all over the world. The labor market is global, so are supply chains. And that, theory goes, is keeping prices from going up. Marketplace's Mitchell Harmon starts us off.
When Fed Chair Powell suggests inflation's low in part because workers can't get traction, UC Berkeley labor economist Jesse Rothstein agrees.
Institutional changes in the labor market have really undercut workers' ability to bargain for higher wages. Things like decline of unions, globalization.
Global supply chains allow importers to find the cheapest suppliers of lawn chairs or laptops and the cheapest workers to make them, says economist Mark Cooperberg at Swarthmore College.
And the possibility of offshoring, it's a huge disincentive to labor to ask for higher wages.
Global outsourcing has really scared workers.
Kate Bronfenbrenner heads up labor education research at Cornell. She says this started a few decades ago in manufacturing.
We now have outsourcing just as high, if not higher, in the service sector and in white-collar jobs. So that there's a feeling that almost any job can be outsourced.
With the internet, companies can find firms or freelancers offering web development, marketing, accounting, legal services. But Adam Ozimek at gig work website Upwork says
the primary way that U.S. businesses have responded to this is to hire remote workers within the U.S. and not to offshore those jobs.
So tech gig workers in San Francisco might make a little less, while their competitors in St. Louis make a little more. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There is, if you want to, on the one hand, on the other hand, this thing. There is another way to think about Jay Powell's answer about why inflation is so low. That same global trend the chairman talked about, that you can make, manufacture, or even provide services anywhere now, applies to consumers, too, not just to businesses buying products and services. Or, as the Wall Street Journal summed it up today, inflation remains low because of factors including consumers' growing tendency toward comparison shopping. Well, yes, but Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on that one.
If you don't like the price you see at the store, what do? You just Google it and find a better price somewhere else or on Amazon.
The ease of searching through places like Amazon does lower the variation in the prices.
Max Gilman is professor of economic history at the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
And that can lead to a lower measured aggregate inflation rate.
It makes sense. Internet comparison shopping has for sure kept prices down. But you know, maybe not as much as we think.
We've had price competition and increasing competition for 100 plus years.
Alan Detmeister is an economist with UBS. Over the decades, we've gone from mom-and-pop stores to specialty stores to big-box stores. Best Buy and Walmart were once revolutionary, just like Amazon is today. But we didn't have this bizarro inflation lull we have today.
It is very easy to overstate the impact of the internet on holding down prices.
Detmeister says if online shopping had single-handedly put the lid on inflation, we would have seen inflation pause for things you can online shop for, but rise for other stuff that you can't as much, like services, transportation, for example. The gap between inflation in goods and services would expand. Spoiler alert, we don't see that.
That gap has been relatively constant.
And you know, comparison shopping with the internet is definitely holding down some prices, but not all. There are bargains for discount shoppers here, but turns out there are sometimes higher prices for people who don't know any better over there. Joe Gagnon is with the Peterson Institute.
Firms are figuring out how they can charge different prices to different buyers for the same thing. Some are going down and some are going up.
This all leaves us with a persistent inflation mystery in economics on our hands. So for now, maybe just stop worrying and be happy prices aren't spiking. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street this Thursday, need one say, really? A Trumpian tweet this morning promising a China trade deal, rumors of it all the live long day. It was Katie Barr at the door. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act ends Sunday, and if you are somebody who tends to wait until the last minute, well, don't do that. There's new research out from the Treasury Department laying out how health insurance affects your health, and you're going to want to hear this. Sarah Cliff covers health policy for the New York Times. She wrote a long piece about this study the other day. Sarah, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to loosely paraphrase the headline of this piece. It basically says health insurance and thus health care saves lives. Explain how this whole story happened.
So this whole story happened a little bit by accident. There was this experiment that we just learned about earlier this week where Treasury sent out letters to 3.9 million Americans letting them know they didn't have health insurance, they're paying a penalty because of the Affordable Care Act, and how they could sign up. And what the researchers found is those letters did encourage some people to sign up. And because it was a large enough sample, they could actually see that those letters ended up saving about 700 lives.
This is what social scientists call, I think I'm getting this right, a randomized controlled study almost by accident.
Exactly. One of the things that's so wild I learned talking to the study authors is this experiment almost never happened. The only reason these letters weren't sent out to everybody was because they didn't have enough budget to buy all the postage and buy all the envelopes. So instead, they sent them out to a smaller share of the group that was paying the mandate penalty. And they ended up creating the first experimental evidence that we have that health insurance saves lives.
Okay. So reading this piece was A, fascinating, but B, a little bit gobsmacking, because somewhere in here, and let me just scroll down and get to the part I highlighted. Here's an economist who does healthcare research, not involved with this Treasury study. She says, there has been a lot of skepticism, especially in economics, that health insurance has a mortality impact. What?
Yeah. So this is one of those things that I think to the public often feels obvious, right?
Yeah.
Like, of course, if you have health insurance, you're going to live longer, you're going to have more access to healthcare. It's been something really hard for economists to prove. You can very rarely randomize who has health insurance and who doesn't. The people who are uninsured are just different from the people who are insured. They tend to have higher mortality rates, but they're also lower income. They have less access to all sorts of resources. And we also know there's a lot of charity care programs and federal regulations that do get people who are uninsured access to certain kinds of health care. So it's actually been a big question in economics.
As you talked to other economists and healthcare policy experts in sort of sussing out this report, are people accepting what seem to be the results?
They generally are. They feel like the things that are unique about this experiment is that it is so large that you can actually detect things that are very small events, such as deaths. You know, death is luckily an infrequent event for the under 65 population, the population that gets private insurance. They feel like this adds to a growing body of research that finds in different sort of ways that health insurance is reducing mortality, both private insurance and public programs like the Medicaid program, which covers millions of Americans.
The catch, of course, is that going back to my rudimentary understanding of social science, Experiments to be valid have to be repeatable, and yet we can't really repeat this experiment because the individual mandate has gone away in the Trump administration.
Exactly. So these letters were sent out in the final weeks of the Obama administration. And the only reason they were sent out was because people were paying fines and the government right. wanted to let people know. As you know, Kai, the mandate penalty was repealed at the end of 2017. And my understanding is these letters have never gone out since this one experiment. So we now know in retrospect, these letters actually saved lives, but there's less of a motivation for the government to send them out at this point.
Sarah Cliff, she's an investigative reporter at the New York Times, does a lot of health policy research. Sarah, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, with everything they've got going on, it's possible, not likely, but it's possible that Congress is going to have to delay the start of its winter recess. Most of us are going to be taking some time off this month, which means you're probably getting a whole lot of those out-of-office emails. We are highlighting some of the more creative ones we've come across in our series, Automatic Reply.
Hello, I am out of the office through Tuesday. I was supposed to be at a sales conference, but through a hotel mix-up, find myself at a dog training seminar instead. Many of the lessons seem applicable, so I think I'll stick it out. There's a good boy.
Mateo Eaton in Boulder, Colorado there. Tell us about an out-of-office reply you've seen, would you? You can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up. Yeah, you know what people eat? Stuff that's raised on farms. That's what they eat. Iowa and the trade war straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 220 today, 0.7%, 28,132. The NASDAQ gained 63 points, about 0.7%, 87.17. The S&P 500 up 26 points, 0.8%, 31.68 there. Delta Airlines added 2.9% today after the firm forecast an increase in profit and revenue next year. American Airlines up 3.2%. Southwest improved 0.9% today. Starbucks frothed up 1.8% after an upgrade from J.P. Morgan. Dunkin' Brands, parent of the Dunkin' Donuts chain, whose coffee, IMHO, is not all that good, dipped 0.1%. Don't at me. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.89%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So, here we are. Mid-December 2019, 18 months, give or take, into President Trump's trade war with China. There is talk today, as yet unconfirmed, but there is talk that there's an agreement on what's called the Phase One deal between Washington and Beijing, pending the president's Twitter feed, of course. But we are going to spend some time on the program today with what has come to be a key sticking point in this whole shebang. You remember when it started? This trade war was about all the really hard things, the structural changes the president wants Beijing to make to its economy, reform of state-owned enterprises, intellectual property protections, the really hard stuff. So hard that it's not getting done in what's being called a phase one deal. What is getting done is ag, corn, and soybeans.
Tonya.
Oh, lovely.
You're working.
Actually, it's, I'm nearing the end. The end is in sight.
What does that mean? That sounds either ominous or good.
No, it's not ominous. It's good. So I'm on my last field right up here.
Yeah.
Everything's waiting for you to drive the combine.
No, really?
Yeah.
April Hemmes has been farming her whole life on land her family's been working since 1901. Corn and soybeans, mostly. We're in Hampton, Franklin County, north central Iowa, population about 4,200. My ride this morning is a combine harvester, a 2009 John Deere 9670, to be exact.
All right, here we are. It's cozy in here. Got a water bottle. It's like a joystick. It's a little bit of a... Wow, that's a nice soft chair.
Okay.
Okay, press that down.
Which one, this one?
No, this one. That's your parking brake.
Oh.
Press that down, and then that's going to do your...
Oh, I see.
This steers it.
So honestly, there's like two big monitors up here.
Right.
There's a satellite picture of where I... Is that
yeah,
where we are?
That's you. Wow. Now you have to select the field we're in.
Oh, April West.
Bain West,
81.
April's fields total about 1,000 acres in all, and we're here because of the hit that April and farmers like her have been taking in this trade war as China, our biggest soybean buyer, has basically stopped.
Okay, now this is farmer, so you have turtle... Almost rabbit and rabbit.
Oh, that's too funny.
Turn it on rabbit.
Rabbit?
Big rabbit. Yep, there you go.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
That this is how you judge speed?
Yes.
Turtle, almost rabbit, and rabbit?
It's for farmers.
Okay, here we go. Here comes the rabbit.
Now, push two. Push two again. Okay, don't touch anything.
I'm not touching anything.
Okay, it's driving itself.
Wow.
China stops buying American agriculture, though they have started again gradually. But they stopped in the beginning. President Trump realizes farmers getting hurt could put him in a political hole. And last summer, the Trump administration announced something called the Market Facilitation Program, MFP, to provide, and here I'm quoting the Department of Agriculture, assistance to farmers and ranchers with commodities directly impacted by unjustified foreign retaliatory tariffs, resulting in the loss of traditional export markets. In all, according to Freedom of Information Act requests filed by Marketplace, more than 1 million payments were made between September of last year and this November the 1st, totaling almost $10.5 billion, including $62,781.51 to April Hemmes. Money she used, she told us, to pay back the line of credit she has to take out every year for seed and supplies. And she said it helps, but it doesn't replace what she would be getting by selling her crops to China.
Let me get you all serious here for a minute.
Yes, sir.
We'll talk more about this later. But as you sit here combining corn, do you ever think about, like, the global economy? Not to be dorky about this, but this is kind of the pointy end of the sword. This is the pointy end of the sword.
Right, it is. And so some of this crop is already marketed for next year.
Oh, wow.
And what isn't... I have to listen to the news.
Yeah.
What's happening in Brazil? What's happening with the trade talks? Are we going to get a deal? Aren't we going to get a deal? Even if we do, is it going to really make a difference in the market? So, just look down.
Yeah, I'm doing, I just looked up to see I'm doing 5.3. Sorry,
but that's okay.
Yeah, I'm coming. I'm all right. Easing off a little bit.
So, this is what farmers are up against. It has been... It's been a total, you know, the you know, storm where everything came together. We had, you know, start with the tariffs, then we have the EPA exemptions, because all this corn right here is going to an ethanol plant.
Why do you do this?
Because I absolutely love to watch things grow. And it's the satisfaction of planting a seed in the spring and watching it grow and caring for it. So, you know, it's
amazing. Stuff is still coming out of the ground.
Yeah. And this is, you know, when you look at Iowa and around here, this is 25% of the world's most fertile soil in the, you know. Yeah. So it's a gift, and I know it. And it's just something, trust me, I would not be getting up at 5 a.m. and working till 11 like yesterday. Yeah. You know, or doing what I do. But, you know, with all this comes you know, I also feel the need to do leadership, too, and have our voices heard, because we're such a small part of the population, and people do not understand where their food comes from.
The food comes from right here. A $200,000 combine that drives itself, tells you how much corn you're getting in real time, and empties itself into the wagons that'll take April's crop to the local co-op.
See? Look
That's
at what
wild.
You've done.
That is kind of wild. I mean, honestly, it really is.
So there you go.
There you go. That's cool. All right.
Okay. Red, yellow button again.
Oh, right. Sorry.
There you go. Yep. Are we done, or are you
Clear.
Going
we're
again?
Done. No, we're done.
Okay.
Not... quite. Lunchtime.
So, the Stumble Inn Bar and Grill. What are those elevators? Is that part of the co-op and all
That's
that?
That's the co-op.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Right by railroad tracks that run from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico.
This is quieter back here.
Okay.
We're a bit on the early side, but a small lunch crowd is trickling in. It's one of those places where everybody kind of knows everybody.
I just want iced tea with lemon.
I'll have a cup of coffee, actually. It'd be great.
Here's the thing about April Hemis. She's somebody in soybean. She's on the board of both the Iowa Soybean Association and the United Soybean Board. She goes back and forth to China, checking up on what used to be America's biggest soybean customer, and she plays the long game.
I'm not supposed to get political.
Well, I think it's interesting that politics hasn't actually come up much this morning.
No.
You guys are just...
Well, I could, but I'm not going to.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess the gist of it is, you guys have work to do.
Right. I had a Belgium TV crew at my place, and he would not stop. Who'd you vote for? Who'd you vote for? And I go, you know what? It doesn't matter who I voted for. It doesn't matter who any farmer voted for. He's our president. The tariffs are in place. We have crappy prices. And this is the environment I have to realize how to make my farm profitable. And that's what I deal with every day.
So the question is, like, for your soybeans, is the Chinese market ever coming back, or are you and your co-op and your buyers looking elsewhere?
I don't think it is, because, and here's, let me start with this, because 35, almost 40 years ago now, United Soybean Export Council put an office in China, because they had the foresight to know that was going to be a big market. And then... we grew that market and grew the demand, which was great, because China made the decision, okay, we're gonna import soybeans to feed our hogs. They're the largest hog producers and their people. Yeah. Okay, that's what we're going to do. We had that market. It was great, you know. But then Brazil came out, and Argentina and all those, so they're putting infrastructure in there, you know, things like that. But what this has done, it's upset the soybean bushel basket.
Yeah. So look. We were talking before, and I'm sure this is just life for you, right? Things happen, you deal, right?
Every day. Bad weather,
floods, whatever.
Yeah.
Is the current, you know, low prices and tariffs and all that, is this just a this too shall pass kind of thing? And you're going to get up tomorrow and figure out how to plant your corn or whatever?
Yeah. I've been doing that for 34 years now. So this is, it's just another bump in the road, as we say.
I don't want to get too grand here, but...
Yeah.
And look, it's been going for 350 years, so this is probably a naive question, but is the farm economy as we know it today sustainable?
Oh, that's a really deep, thoughtful question. It is for me in my lifetime, in my farming, you know, because it is what I know. But technology is going to change everything, I believe, you know, whether it's the seed or how we harvest and things like that. So... you know, it's just like industries adapt to new technology. Farming will adapt too, and we're early adapters. You just got to drive that combine, Jerry.
I know.
Thank you. Push two, and it right,
yeah.
Right. So I think farming, as I know it, will not look the same in 50 years. It won't look the same in 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, because you know what? At the end of the day, people got to eat. They don't eat cell phones. They don't need Apple products. They have to eat. And that's kind of the bottom line. I don't know. Maybe that's oversimplified, but, you know.
The thing about global trade, which is really what this story's about, even though on the face of it, it's about getting corn in a combine. Thing is, it's not that simple. It's complicated and difficult and can't be told in just one go. So, More from Iowa next week on the program. And in the meanwhile, we've put our FOIA data on the Trump administration subsidies to farmers online. Also, you can get a sneak peek of what's coming up in the video we shot while we were out there. All of it is at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, the perils of social media gone wrong. Today was election day over in the UK, as we have been telling you. Brexit is the issue. Will Britain be in or out of the European Union? The Labour Party says it could offer a second referendum if it wins. The Conservatives say Brexit means Brexit. Sadly, the Tories' Twitter feed today said, and this is sadly for them a quote, it said, "Get Brexit done." Brexit. David Brancaccio and the gang on The Morning Show will have the results for you before the sun comes up. Here's a preview. The exit polls, oh, they really like Boris Johnson. Okay, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 220 today, 0.7%. The NASDAQ gained 63 points, also 0.7%. S&P 500 up 26, that is 0.8%. On news, talk, take your pick of the China trade deal. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, and Aaron Bekela are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.